Hello and welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists, and opinion makers who bridge our two worlds. This podcast was brought to you by the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. I'm Martha Legutsky, and I'll be your host today. I'm in the Korean Context studio with Ambassador Kathleen Stevens, the U.S. Ambassador to South Korea. It's a great honor to be speaking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So as a member of the Peace Corps, you spent some time in South Korea between 1975 and 77. What was life like for a young foreigner, particularly female and American, living on her own in South Korea at a time that preceded the democratic movement of the 1980s?
Well, how long do we have? Yes, I arrived in Korea in 1975 and spent most of my time after an initial 10 weeks studying Korean in a provincial city called Cheongju in the province of Chungcheongnam-do. But I traveled throughout Korea and spent most of my time outside of Seoul and in the countryside. It was a very different country then and a very different life. It was physically challenging in many ways. Korea was just beginning to industrialize, but things such as plumbing and heat had not reached houses, certainly in the countryside, but even in the cities. So part of the experience for me was as a young woman, as an American who'd grown up in the southwestern United States, was just adjusting to the change of the seasons, the cold, some of the physical challenges. I was witnessing Korea starting on what I call its first great transformation, its economic transformation, where although the per capita income had only recently surpassed that of North Korea's and was still at a level with many, are still far less developed countries, I didn't have a sense that Koreans thought of themselves as poor. There was a great deal of ambition, education was very valued, and you could see that this was a country that was changing. Now, that's something that hasn't changed about Korea. It changes. In terms of the political atmosphere, yes, it was a time of Park Chung-hee's presidency. The Yushin Constitution was in effect. It was not martial law, but there were curfews, which meant if you stayed out after midnight, you had to stay wherever you were until 4 the next morning. None of these are things that particularly affected me as a woman any differently. As an American, I was a rare sight. The places where I went were places where people hadn't seen foreigners before. And so I was a source of good gugyeong, of good sightseeing for everybody. And that was true whether you were male or female. But perhaps especially if you were tall and had curly blonde hair and were female, you were probably better gugyeong than some of the others. So there was a certain sense of notoriety of being around in Korea those days and trying to speak Korean and live in a Korean environment. And I remember that there were things we were told, of course, as Peace Corps volunteers, that we needed to stay out of politics. And there wasn't a whole lot of politics talked about in the countryside or indeed in most of the circles I moved in. But there were things that would really annoy me. And the one that annoyed me the most was that whenever I got my window on the outside world, which is my weekly edition of Time magazine, remember, this is before internet, it would arrive with sections of it carefully blacked out by hand and with pages torn out. If they had anything, not only anything in any way critical of South Korea itself, but anything that was considered to be slightly pro-communist, remember, again, this is the Cold War, leftist, anything like that. And I so prized my weekly Time magazine, my one English source of news, that I became quite angry whenever it would come censored like that. But you know, it was a different time in Korea. It was things were the president's wife had just been assassinated mm-hmm. while I was there. You had the axe murder at Panmunjom. Mm-hmm. We had weekly, monthly civil defense drills. So there was a sense the whole security atmosphere was very different, and it really did get me thinking about things like the tension between political freedom and security. And how Korea was going to approach it, because certainly people were very aware of that and already talking about it.
Obviously, as you've described, the quality of life has changed dramatically since the first time you were in South Korea. And also, if you look at technology, mm-hmm. South Korea is now the most wired internet provider in the world.
As President Obama noted in his State of the Union address, yes.
Yes. In the midst of all of this sweeping change in South Korea, have the people changed at all?
I find Koreans today to be more confident and more global than they were, certainly, not just 35 years ago, but even 20 or so years ago when I lived in Korea again as a political officer at the embassy. But, you know, fundamentally, there is a strong sense of Korean identity, of the force of Korean culture and history, pride in that, values of family and hard work and education. I mean, those were certainly there then, and they're there now. And also a sense of hyper-competitiveness, you know, just as it's important now to sort of be number one. You know, it was important then. So those kinds of national characteristics, if you like, are still very much there. But what I do see, as I said, is a much greater feeling of confidence. I mean, when I first arrived in Korea, Korea had a pretty tough century, if you think about it. And now I see in Korea growing confidence and also a really comfortable sense that Korea's future is a part, is a very wired part, not only of the whole country, but of the world and as a global player.
I'd love to ask you a quick question about your experience with Peace Corps.
Yeah.
How has that influenced your relationship with diplomacy?
Well, I went to Korea as a Peace Corps volunteer because I had developed an interest in U.S.-China relations and U.S. relations with East Asia, but also just a real curiosity about what was happening in that part of the world. I think for those of us, and I am not alone in this, those of us who've gone into a diplomatic career from the Peace Corps, what I do see in many of us is a strong sense that to be a good diplomat, you've got to do everything you can to try to understand what's going on in the country. I mean, you'd say that's well, it's true of all diplomats. But I think if you come out of the Peace Corps experience, what it does give you is the experience of living under, in my case, purely Korean rules. You know, I didn't have an American boss. I was the only American in my town. You know, the expectations of me, I mean, people knew I was American, but, you know, I had to try to adapt to Korean expectations as much as I could and still be true to myself and to what I was trying to do there. And that was a huge challenge. And I think it's made me, as a diplomat, more observant, more intellectually curious. And I also, through that time in the Peace Corps, I learned that, you know, you've got to be patient. That things don't, you can learn that from a lot of things in life, but certainly that you can't change things all at once. And before you can begin to influence things, you have to kind of understand where the people are coming from. That certainly is something that comes through when you have a Peace Corps experience.
You are unique from your predecessors in a few ways. First of all, you are the first female ambassador to South Korea, but you are also the first to speak Korean fluently. Mm-hmm. How important has the language component been?
Well, I think it's very important, and I felt in every foreign service assignment I've had, and I've been in the U.S. diplomatic service for now over 30 years, actually almost 33 years, I've always felt that learning the language, or at least trying to learn the language, was the one most important thing you could do to try to be effective in your job and try to understand what's going on. But the fact that I tried it even as ambassador to Korea. It has had an impact, mm-hmm. and I think it's been extremely helpful. I just don't think you can understand a place without at least giving the language a try. But certainly, it means that my range of contacts has expanded so much. People can come up to me on the street and talk to me, and they don't feel that there's a barrier between us. So people do. People express themselves differently, as you know, depending on the language they're speaking. And when it comes to my own communication, while, you know, my Korean is far from sufficient, people appreciate the effort. And I think in a country like Korea, where people spend so much time and effort and angst trying to learn English, actually the fact that the American ambassador is speaking Korean, or at least trying to speak Korean, means people appreciate the effort. I think they take it as a sign of respect, which it is. And so they forgive my shortcomings and my errors and my imprecisions. So I think it's been hugely important.
Now, has your command of the Korean language perhaps influenced the expectations of your Korean counterparts of you, or has it also influenced your expectations for yourself for what you can accomplish while you're there.
Well, you know, it is very hard in a way because, again, my Korean is a work in progress. It always has been. I hadn't used it for almost 20 years when I came back to Korea as ambassador, and I had a lot of kind of, you know, wire brushing of the rust on it, and it's hard in an aging brain. And I had a lot of overlays of other languages on top of it, and I was never that good to begin with, actually. So it's been a struggle, and it's one of those things where it's like my tennis game. I'm never as good as I think I should be or could be. But as I said, I think people appreciate the effort. But frankly, it does take a lot of work. Even now, if I'm going to do a speech in Korean, if I'm going to do a meeting in Korean, I feel like I have to prepare all the more for it. It's just more pressure. But it's worth it. People appreciate it. And I found what really happens now is because I make the effort, I find Koreans who might normally, say, use an interpreter for everything, they'll try to use what English they have. Oh. And when it comes to meetings, I find with many people I get into a conversation where they speak to me in Korean because, of course, my listening comprehension is much better than my speaking ability, my production ability, and I speak in English. And then when we don't understand each other, we help each other. So that makes for actually the most smooth and fluid kind of communication that I can have in a private setting. In a public setting, I've just tried to get over my stage fright and just to use it whenever I think it helps to make a connection.
Specifically, as the first female ambassador to South Korea, what would you want your legacy to be after your time in Korea?
Well, specifically as the first woman, I mean, two things. I'm just part of a generation of women's foreign service officers, where most of the jobs I've had in the foreign service has been as the first woman, you know, just my generation. But what's really nice to see from this point in my life and in career is that in almost all those jobs, I am no longer the only woman. And again, you would find that true of many women of my generation. So obviously part of it is that you hope that once a woman serves in a job where there hasn't been a woman before, it kind of opens up, you know, people's notions and ideas of Koreans and Americans, men and women alike, that, you know, actually this works fine. But, you know, I think, and not to put myself in her category, I'm an admirer of Drew Faust, who's the president of Harvard, and she's the first woman to be president of Harvard. Mm-hmm. And she said when she took that job, she said, I don't want to be known as the woman president of Harvard. I am the president of Harvard who happens to be a woman, and I want to be the best president of Harvard I can be. Well, I want to be the best ambassador, American ambassador to Korea, that I can be. But if the fact, and here I'm also kind of paraphrasing, I think, what President Faust found in her job and what I found being in Korea, if in trying to be the best possible American ambassador to Korea that I can be, if I inspire some young women, if I open the ideas and minds of young men and women in Korea and the United States alike, that's a very, it's a privilege to play that role. That's, I guess, how I would look at it.
Your tenure as ambassador has seen several crisis situations or high-tension situations occur, most recently the shelling of South Korea's Yeongkyong Island. Mm-hmm. Would you describe what happens on a day when you receive the news of such an event?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've felt throughout my career that you can almost count on crises happening either late at night or on a weekend, or especially on a three-day weekend. And that's not to be too lighthearted about very serious incidents. But, I mean, it is part of what we do. We are on duty, you know, 24/7, and we have to always be ready for crises, for developments that we have to respond to quickly. And I think we have a long history as the United States working with our Korean allies, both on the diplomatic side and the military side, in communicating closely. So basically, I mean, however I hear about an incident, our first instinct is to make sure that the flow of information and cooperation between our Korean allies, between the military on the Korean and the American side, and the embassy in Washington is as close and as full as it possibly can be. But I, in terms of, you know, what it feels like, you mentioned the shelling of Yeongpyeong Island, which is, the most recent provocation by the North Koreans. That was a different feel, I think, for those of us who were in Korea, and I'll tell you why. I happened, it's one of those incidents where I think if you've talked to anyone in Korea, Korean or non-Korean, who were in the country at the time, they'd probably remember kind of where they were when they heard about it. And I was riding in my car, and the driver of my car said to me, this is where it helps to know Korean, so he said there's been an attack on this island, and then he said an artillery attack, and so I had to think attack, you know, how do you say that in Korean? And then we turned on the radio and we listened a little bit, and then my assistant, a Korean assistant in the car, pulled up on her smartphone, which every young Korean has, and which I don't know how to use very well, a video, and wow. The smoke is going up. You know, and you're seeing this attack happen before your eyes. So this is all before I've had an official word from anybody.
Right.
So I immediately called the embassy, and then I called General Sharp, who was trying to call me. But I'm watching it on this smartphone in the hands of a young Korean. And then when we got to my destination, which actually was Incheon Airport, so not very far from where this is occurring, this was kind of the unforgettable scene to me, was everyone had their phones out, and everyone was watching. If you know, both in real, at first in real time for many of them, and then just shortly afterwards, they were, you know, replaying this footage of the shells hitting Yeongpyeongdo and all the smoke going up. So that had an immediacy about it, which hit not only me, but I think or struck not only me, but everyone in Korea. This was happening. So you're sitting there in Incheon, and you realize it's it's happening right out there, and you see the effects of it. That's what I think made the impact of it. A little bit different, actually, than some of, you know, the earlier provocations, which we've dealt with and which we will continue to deal with, I'm afraid, if we, you know, and certainly if we need to over the years. You know, in the case of, for example, the sinking of the Cheonan, that happened at night and it was very unclear. Mm-hmm. And obviously there had to be an investigation of it. So it unfolded in a different way. But the sinking of the artillery attack on Yeongpyeong Island had a very immediate and dramatic impact in Korea on Koreans, and I could see that because I was also experiencing it myself.
You spoke about these dozens of people standing around you with their smartphones on and looking at the footage. The difference is, though, that they're observing and they continue to observe, mm-hmm. whereas you have to turn around and then act. Do you need to take a minute just to recollect yourself, or do you just jump right in and have to start making decisions?
You know, I think over years. Again, I've been at this for a long time. Mm-hmm. I've been in a lot of places where, I mean, unfortunately, there's been issues of conflict or crisis, and I think it is something that we become adapted to. We try to make plans for these things. I mean, you never know exactly what's going to happen, but we have a pretty good idea of who we need to talk to and how we need to coordinate and how we need to get the embassy into action.
WikiLeaks has leaked a number of documents that you classified at the embassy in Seoul. How did you feel about that?
Well, when this WikiLeaks episode began, I was very grateful that Secretary Clinton and her leadership in Washington took such a clear position on it. I mean, as you know, these are the whole episode is one that we don't really talk about in detail because mm-hmm. these are documents that allege to be reports on reports filed by embassies and others throughout the world, and we just don't comment on materials, including classified documents, which may have been leaked. But I think that it was very important for Secretary Clinton and others in the leadership to stand up and say how damaging this is, mm-hmm. how damaging this is to the work we do as diplomats. You know, our work as diplomats, as we were talking about earlier, is to do our very best to try to understand, to talk to people in the country, to find out what's going on there, to understand it better, and to share that information with our colleagues in Washington so that the policy that we develop can be as well-informed as possible and as understanding of the trends and the thoughts into that country. So my reaction was really, as someone who has practiced this profession for over 30 years, as someone who has understood that diplomacy is based on relationships, it's based on trust, it's based on, I mean, the kinds of things that other professions look to, whether you're a journalist or a lawyer or a doctor, these are the things that you rely on, and that trust and confidentiality I think has been eroded by what's happened. And so what we need to do is to try to restore it as much as we can, because we need to continue this important work of diplomacy. And that's true wherever you are.
If WikiLeaks or some WikiLeaks-like organization is here to stay, do you think that this could actually change the way that we practice diplomacy?
Yeah. I do think that it's important to, call me old-fashioned, but I think it's important that that governments, as well as other organizations, have a means of ensuring some confidentiality for negotiations, for discussions. And so we need to ensure that we can do that. To maybe answer your question in a slightly different way, I mean, what struck me being in Korea as ambassador is not only some of the challenges that we've talked about in connection with WikiLeaks, but also the fact that you mentioned a Korea being such a wired society is that we're also such a videotape society. I mean, I know we're not videotaping today, but I'm really struck by the fact that kind of wherever I go, whatever group I speak to, it could be posted on the website like forever, So I think there's just a much more public element to everything we do, which is fine. I mean, we're here to communicate with the public, and we're for that. But I also, frankly, I mean, just sometimes wish I could have more conversations with, say, a group of students, that I felt we could just have, and we could all just speak without thinking, gosh, this is going to be posted on the internet and for everybody to see. So I find it's tilted much more towards, we've really got to think, is this going to stand up to scrutiny by the whole world? And a little bit harder to have the more, not secret, but just more conversations that you would have when you know that you're not being filmed all the time. So
it does change things.
It does change things. It does. But that's not just true of diplomacy. Right. That's true of business. That's true of journalism. That's true of everything we do. So in that sense, yes, I think our world has changed. And I'm not saying it's all in a completely bad way. I mean, I do think that. One of the things that's been very useful in Korea is to try to reach out to more people, to reach beyond our traditional circles of friends and contacts and influential elites, and to connect with people. And we need modern technology to do that. But there's also a place for confidentiality, and certainly when it comes to negotiations or very sensitive topics and things where sometimes people's lives are at risk. You need to have a means of ensuring that confidentiality.
Now, you call yourself old-fashioned, but you also have embraced social media as a way to communicate with the public in Korea, and particularly young Koreans, I think, for example, in the form of blogging. Mm. How has the use of social media enhanced your relationship with the Korean public?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm still trying to figure that out. But my staff at the embassy suggested that I do a blog, and I have to say I was quite hesitant about it. I wasn't exactly sure how it would go or what I would write about. But it's been a very positive experience for me. One, it's given me a way of responding to some of the interests that Koreans have along some of the lines of the questions you've asked me. How has Korea changed since you first came here? What's it like, especially as a woman? Or, what kind of changes do you see? All those things that I wouldn't sort of normally highlight in my kind of normal, everyday official work. So it's gotten me to reflect on it, and then it's provided a venue for Koreans to respond to it. So I think it's helped me to understand Korea, and to update my own notions about Korea, because it's a mistake to come back to any country, I mean including your own, or a country you've been in many years ago, and think that all the knowledge you had from before are going to be immediately applicable or even relevant. So it's been helpful in that way. But I think this is something we're still figuring out as diplomats, I guess as human beings too. It evolves so quickly. I'm fascinated by it.
I'm still figuring out podcasting myself.
Yeah, exactly.
So you clearly have a lot on your plate, and as you mentioned, you're on call 24/7. Do you have any opportunity to enjoy yourself?
No, absolutely, it's one of the best things about being in Korea. The very first weekend I was in Korea, I went for a hike in Dobongsan with Sagong-il, not to drop names, and that was even before we knew that Korea was going to host the G20, but it was the day after Lehman Brothers collapsed. So as we hiked up the mountain, I peppered Dr. Sagong, who's in great shape, with questions about the world economy. So I actually find hiking a great way to combine fun, because I do love to hike, with a little bit of work, because you can talk to people. But that's another thing. You asked me earlier what had changed about Korea. One thing that has not changed about Korea, and I consider it to be really intrinsic to what sort of the Korean character is, a great love of the outdoors and a love of nature. And one thing that makes me so happy about being in Seoul now is that really from downtown Seoul, I can walk up Bukhaksan. Mm-hmm. I can walk up the mountains that previously were closed for security reasons and now are right there. I don't think there's another city in the world where you have those kinds of hills where you get immediately into such kind of a mountain experience with a city of 10 million or more, I guess, all around you. So yes, I do a lot of that. And mountains are important to Koreans, you know. I was in Gwangju about a year ago, and we hiked up Mudungsan, and I'd always seen it there when I'd gone to Gwangju years ago, but I'd never hiked up. It may have been close, too, but now there are wonderful hiking trails. And I have to say, of all the things I did in Gwangju, I did a number of things which are far more sort of traditional, if you like. And I'm doing this for fun, not to worry. This is a fun thing to do. You know, I made speeches, and I met leading officials and people from all walks of life. But everyone I know from Gwangju said, wow, you climbed up Mudungsan. Why did you do that? It had a lot of symbolism to it, too. So I've actually found, since you mentioned hiking, the hiking to be kind of a great way to do my job as well as something. That's the best thing in life, right, when you find this, as well as something I would just do because it's fun. But I also love to bike, and I've been doing a lot of biking in Korea, and I love to play tennis. So it's always been my approach in diplomacy that you'll find, or in life, you know, find something you really like to do, and then then you do it with passion. And if it fits in with your work, you know, all the better.
So I asked you what you do outside of work, and you said that for leisure you bring it into,
absolutely,
into hiking.
you just combine it, yeah.
So you mentioned the G20. I actually spoke with Ambassador Han Duck-soo right before Seoul hosted the G20 summit in November last year, and he told me that South Korea was trying to increase its presence as a donor country in the international aid community, mm-hmm, particularly in Africa. Mm-hmm. Do you have any insights as to how this is going?
Yes, well, it's something I do spend a good deal of time on. You know, Korea, and I'm sure you heard more authoritative information from Ambassador Han, but Korea has made a commitment to make a significant increase in its overseas development budget over a number of years. And I see the results of it in terms of the kind of engagement I see Korea doing throughout the world. Part of it, which is of course very close to my heart, is their volunteer program. Mm-hmm. You know, Korea is the only country that I know of, I'm sure, that used to be a Peace Corps recipient country, and now sends volunteers overseas. Mm-hmm. And they send lots of them overseas, and I've met a lot of them. You know, President Lee has sort of send-offs for them before they go out, and I've been to a number of those, and they're just filled with these enthusiastic young and also not so young Koreans who are taking a whole range of skills throughout the world, and we see them when they come back. President Obama met a former Korean volunteer who'd been in Indonesia, and they spoke to each other in Indonesian when President Obama visited in November 2009. So there's a lot of synergies I think we have, and we've tried to develop between some of our former Peace Corps volunteers in this 50th year of the founding of the Peace Corps with the new Korean volunteers. We're working on that. And in terms of their development programs, of course, Korea has stood up a robust presence in Afghanistan, where they are doing great things in education, mm-hmm, and in vocational training in particular. And I've seen that really throughout not only Africa, but Central Asia, Southeast Asia, Latin America. Mm-hmm. I've met young Koreans who've come back from all over the world, and they bring back with them, whether they go as volunteers or as experts in assistance, they bring back with them a real understanding of how the rest of the world works, you know. And again, it's contributing to make Korea more global. But no, the
the engagement around the world is really impressive and really striking. And I think there's a lot of areas, frankly, in which the U.S. and Korea can cooperate closely together. In fact, we're looking, two foreign ministers agreed that we were going to look for ways in which we could find some synergies and work together on development projects. And finally, I would say, I know that that Korea is hosting a major development a meeting, I don't know if you've heard about this, called the Aid Effectiveness, it's not a summit, but it's a meeting of all the senior aid people throughout the world, which will occur towards the end of this year in Busan. So that's all part of Korea's commitment to being much more of a player in the international development area.
Ambassador Stevens, I could ask you questions for hours, but we'll have to end it there. I really, really appreciate you giving us this opportunity today.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much. My pleasure. Thank you.
For more information about this episode, this podcast, and upcoming KEI events, please check out our podcast page at keia.podbean.com. As always, please feel free to send any questions, comments, or suggested podcast topics to me at podcast@keia.org. I'd love to hear from you, so please don't be shy. Well, that's all for now. Thanks so much for listening. It was a pleasure to have you, and we look forward to seeing you next time on Korean Context. Bye.